Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We are also streamed live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com, and we also link to our guests, so we encourage you to go to their website and see what we've been talking about in the context of this interview and check out the information that they have as well. We hope you will join us for this next hour as we talk with the author of, I was actually going to start the interview by saying we were going to talk with Thomas Edison. Something like that. Yes, it's the book entitled Reinvent Yourself, Essential Tools from a Brooklyn Psychiatrist Who Has Seen It All. That's probably going to be one of my first questions. Have you really seen it all? Johnny Lopes, and thank you so much for joining us on the program, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's interesting how we've heard that term, reinvent yourself, even more so here into the 21st century, especially as technology technology seems to be the driving force behind reinventing oneself. But there are a lot of folks who were born, in some instances, long before the computer was ever developed or shortly thereafter, who really, A, may not quite fully understand what it means to reinvent themselves, and B, really don't want to. What is wrong with the version of me that I am? Why do I have to upgrade to 2.0?
Well, nobody says you have to. It all comes down to if you're finding time and time again, there might be certain interactions or aspects of life, whether it's dealing with your family, whether it's dealing with conflict, whether it's dealing with your emotions, that you're recognizing that you just don't have the tools to work with, and you keep finding yourself frustrated, overwhelmed, behind the eight ball. It's that insight. It's that the first step is that recognizing that maybe there's a tool that I didn't properly develop through the midst of my childhood into early adulthood and so forth that might be the key about why you persistently have pain in certain avenues of life.
But how would we know if we were missing that tool?
Exactly. You have to read my book. But that's the nutshell of a lot of what therapy is about, too. It's the idea that if everyone easily was aware of what the difficulties they had and where the persistent concerns and issues are, then it might be as easy as just Googling that and find the answers. But a lot of times people are just not aware of certain parts of themselves that might not be operating at full capacity, that if they could strengthen that tool, they might be more apt to do better. So it's still just starting at step one and saying, hey, there's something about me that I can't seem to overcome, or I'm having some difficulty, and that proactive approach to either listen to a show like yours, read a book like mine, do some homework and recognize, at least get an idea of what path you might need to go down to see if you can if there's someone that can help you.
Well, and of course, that's one of the reasons why we do this program, obviously, is to hopefully open people's eyes to new and different ways of doing things.
Exactly.
The subtitle, so to speak, is choices, giving people choices and knowledge of those choices. But if you don't know they exist, you can't choose them. And in the same instance, by the same instance, if you don't know that you're missing a particular attribute of who you are, you haven't delved into that, no matter how old you are or when you were born, it makes it very difficult. And that's why I'm a strong advocate for a wide and diverse, in particularly, a wide and diverse education.
Yes.
You know, I've just kind of had it up to here with, let's throw more money at it. Money has not solved the problem, and that isn't the issue. It's what is it that you are being taught? How many different options are you being given? Now, I'm not going to sit here with you and debate whether or not creationism or grand design or evolution are the origins of the universe. I'm saying, How many different origins of the universe theories are there, and why can't we be taught all of them? What really frustrates me, Johnny, is the fact that we did a mythology series last year on this program called Mythosophia, Exploring, Entertaining the Depths of Myth and Wisdom. I know some of the Greek gods, for example, because some of the planets are named after them. I don't know the stories, at least not consciously. I may have heard them somewhere, and maybe if someone refreshed my memory, they may come back to mind. But as I started doing this series, I began to realize that there was more to mythology than just the Greek gods. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was like the floodgates were open. Now, I'm still overwhelmed by the content that we discussed, and we're hoping to continue that series. But the point is that I didn't know about all of this other stuff that, who knows, could have been extremely helpful in my upbringing, you know.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I haven't read, for example, a lot of the classics. I'm still working my way through a very old book called The Stranger in a Strange Land, let alone Ulysses or other great works that are considered the classics.
Yeah.
I haven't read Dante's Inferno, let alone seen it in a comic book, for that matter. But it's that kind of thing, I think, that we're trying to approach. Now, I think it's really interesting, too, in terms of this whole aspect. What little I know, this goes now really to sort of the heart of education, and you're going to educate me here. I know very little about what life was like for you in Brooklyn, other than what I've seen on TV. Now, I had a good friend who was born and raised in New York, and back in 2001, for example, I'm an avid baseball fan, when I was living in Phoenix and when our D-backs beat the New York Yankees, he said it was a fluke. And I thought, no, because that means that the Yankees curled up and died, and they did not. They fought to the bitter end. But I just, and I loved a lot of the stories that he used to tell me about his growing up. So what were the elements of your childhood that have brought you to this place where you now understand better this whole aspect, and you're now sharing it with us, of reinventing ourselves?
I think a lot of it had to do with the multitude of stressors and the plethora of experiences that forced me to reflect on what would be appropriate in terms of my upbringing and what wouldn't be. I think it took time to realize that I was fortunate to survive a lot of the micro traumas that I experienced, whether it was being shot at, robbed at knife point, being surrounded by gang activities, to slowly accumulate the emotional intelligence. And I'm using this term emotional intelligence because I want to connect it to what you were saying about how there's a lot of different educations that we in this country don't receive. And one of my favorite mentors had a great line that I completely agree with, especially as a child psychiatrist, where he said, you know, if only we spent a semblance of time teaching our young people how to manage their emotions as we do with helping them tie their shoes and learn how to ride a bike at around age 5, 6, we wouldn't be having half as much difficulties in the world when we're adults. And there's a lot of truth to that. We just don't. Parents are not educated enough themselves, the vernacular. Schools don't provide that type of education. And so a lot of people, if they don't have the right experiences, they're just going to grow up into their late teens, early 20s, facing this very challenging world without the emotional tools to manage their emotions as they get stressed out, trying to navigate their first job, how to navigate relationships, how to navigate being independent and autonomous. And so I think because of my sort of wacky upbringing, where I too didn't have parents that were emotionally intelligent, and I didn't go to a schools, but I was very fortunate to have this determination to survive the upbringing I had and to continue to overcome them regardless of the trauma it was, to become as successful as I could possibly be. I was very determined. And so I realized that through a lot of the hardships, that it took a lot of insight and reflection in asking the right questions. Now that I've faced these challenges or these traumas, what needs to be done to continue to be on the right pathway to assure that I'm still straight and arrow, for lack of better terms, to achieve the success I want. So, I mean, to be more specific to the questions you asked, I mean, yeah, it was pretty challenging, where it was a lot of violence growing up in Brooklyn, in South Brooklyn in the late 80s, playing basketball with some very dangerous characters who were, you know, there was guns, there was drugs, a lot of folks. I was so young, I would see someone I knew who was older play basketball and then not see him for a year and had no wherewithal to understand why he would possibly be gone. And then he'd come back and I'd be like, hey, Mike, where you been? He was like, oh, jail. I was like, oh. You know, it was just so matter of fact as a nine-year-old to be around these hooligans that were participating in these type of activities. And it sort of gave me the mental resilience to sort of overcome those type of challenges. But at the same time, I was devoid of learning how to create healthy friendships or how to start developing relationships to have a girlfriend, for that matter. And so what I'm trying to profess in the book is that certain experiences in our life can either accentuate certain types of things for us, but it also could cause deficits. And it takes the wherewithal to recognize what you're falling behind in and making that first proactive step to work on it. As my book states, going into my college years, I was so behind in trying to develop healthy friendships and also have a girlfriend that I don't want to give away too many of the stories, but there's a lot of comical moments I share with the readers about just missing so many cues, not understanding that wearing Notre Dame football, full-on apparel, sweatshirt, sweatpants, hat, was not probably the right fashion statement to be making on a college campus that wasn't Notre Dame. So, you know, I definitely was a late bloomer in a lot of ways, and they're very similar to a lot of things I see in my practice of young people struggling to understand why they can't progress further, and it takes my insight and reflections to navigate with them. So I'm hoping the readers will be inspired by some of my stories to recognize, as we were starting this show, about recognizing what they might be behind, because I didn't see it. That's the key point of this book, is I myself didn't have the eyes to see it, because my mind didn't know. It took mentorship and other friends who advocated for me to identify for me that there were certain things that I was behind. And so whereas I was getting sad and depressed because it wasn't working out for me, it took that curiosity to ask others, what am I missing? And that's what I'm trying to inspire people to do.
Well, but then there's the paradox to all of this, and that is, and I've heard this so many times, especially in relation to kids. And I myself grew up in the Phoenix school system under the tutelage, if you will. I can kind of put it that way, of the bullies. Yep. But you and I wouldn't be here talking, most likely, we would not be here talking if we hadn't gone through those, as a lot of old school parents would say, a lot of those character building experiences that have made us who we are. And so how do you counterbalance that?
To counterbalance going through those type of micro traumas as a child?
Yeah. I mean, if you were to weed all of those crises and challenges out of a child's life to give them, let's just say this was the attitude, the perspective, to give them the opportunity to really get a good education so that they could get a really good job and do the thing that they, you know, live their purpose, et cetera, as opposed to now I'm in my 20s, 30s, 40s, and I'm going to therapy every three times a week to deal with the garbage that I had to deal with back then.
Right. Well, I think it takes, you know, parenting. I think it takes the parents to nurture how the parents are going to respond to the child who's being bullied is a big facet of how that child can develop emotionally. If the parents sort of don't handle it properly or overreact, or well, of course, I mean, there's always the different levels of bullying. You want to make sure a child's safe. You know, a lot of bullying behavior can lead to a lot of anxiety and depression for our youngsters, and our parents want to make sure that their kids are getting the proper treatment if need be. But regardless, how the parents are going to work with that child in navigating how to handle bullies is going to be a big facet of how they're going to navigate their adult life when they have those type of stressors with maybe bullying bosses, bullying peers at work, bullying relationships, trying to sort of stabilize that child's emotional experience that there are really difficult people out there, but we have to come up with the tools to handle that, whether it's finding the right people to reach out to, whether it's problem solving and trying to avoid them, or even, you know, let's be honest, or how to navigate talking back to the bully and not letting them see that you're being emotionally negated by their attempts and that you're not going to tolerate their behaviors and you're going to stand up for yourself. So I really think it takes that relationship with the child and their parents to inform them that this is occurring and try to, and it's going to depend on how the parents navigate it with them. That's going to inherently teach that child how to handle those type of conflicts. So you and I, for example, if we both went through these type of challenging childhood experiences, there was just something in our upbringing from our parents, from the healthy adults around us, that gave us the wherewithal to sort of not emotionally crumble, not fall apart, and develop the resilience to overcome those type of hurdles so that we're not having to deal with them later in life. But a lot of people I see, they just had either absent parents or they had parents that were too focused on gaining affluence and they didn't have family dinners where they talked about each other's issues, or they came from absent parents that they didn't have a parent to talk to, or the parent had to work too much so there was no other parent in the household. So it all comes down to that family unit and trying to assure that the child has an avenue to talk about these things so they could work through it then, not later in life.
Hmm. You know, there's a movie I just watched that I found really interesting and actually kind of was looking at it even from the perspective you're speaking of. The movie is a comedy called Last Vegas. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I see it on the TV show. I see it on the cable, like, being available.
Yeah, with Morgan Freeman and Robert Klein, I believe it is.
Yes, that's right.
They're De Niro and Douglas, Michael Douglas. And what's interesting is it's the Flatbush Boys, as they're called, as kids. And, of course, they show the various events that happen as they were kids. But it turns out there's one event in particular, which I will not reveal. I think people should see the film, two of the four boys, as adults, still have issues over. It turns out, though, that if one had told the other what had happened, they probably would have been literally friends the entire period of the 50 or 60 years that they lived until they ended up in Vegas and had their little adventure.
Right.
But it wasn't until they had their little adventure there in Vegas that all of this finally came out. And they finally realized that, man, in spite of the fact that I've been mad at you for 58 years,
right,
you actually did me a solid.
Yes. So what are we talking about? So what happened there? I see this all the time. I practice conflict resolution and the ability to express our emotions.
Yeah.
And if we struggle with two of those skills that we didn't develop again, as I continue to revert back to, then we're going to avoid conflict. We're not going to be able to express our feelings with others. And what do anxious people do when they have things they can't tolerate? They avoid. And just like, I guess, the fun part of this plot is that they avoid it for 58 years, what could have been a very strong, long-lasting relationship. And it took a trip to Vegas to recognize that they both wanted to work through the relationship, but neither had the skill set to approach that. And that's, again, that becomes extremely something common in my practice between relationships with friendships, with family members. I see a lot of young people that feel kind of paralyzed to express to their parents, or vice versa, certain things. And it goes back to the lack of that skill ever being created. And that I'm happy you brought this up, because that's a perfect example of what my book is about. It's that we avoid a lot of things, or we take shortcuts because we can't tolerate certain parts of the human experience that we don't realize are just not, it's not, oh, I don't have it, I don't know how to do this. It's a skill. It's just like tying a shoe or riding a bike. And the more you work that skill out at an early age, teaching a young person how to, go up to somebody that you might be angry with and say, hey, I'm quite angry with you. Do you think we can talk this out to resolve this? If you start doing that with young people as early as, 8, 9, 10, 11, when you're 20, 25 years old and you have a friendship that's on the line, you'll be more willing to call them up, text them, email them, and say, hey, I don't want to not speak to you for 58 years. Do you think we can meet for coffee and just express with each other how the difficulties we had, this conflict, and see if we can resolve this?
Yeah. I think that a big part of the resolution, too, it seems to me, is being willing to be open enough to understand the other's perspective. Doesn't make it right or wrong, but just understanding where they were coming from, and hopefully they return the favor, as well as being able to express yourself and how you're feeling about. I still have a very dear friend who he and I took a road trip back in, I think it was 1980. We drove from Phoenix all the way to Kansas. They say that, friends should never drive on long trips together because it could end a friendship. Well, it almost did. And it almost ended over money. But I got to the point when we got back from our trip where I said, look, because I didn't want to have to deal with this later. I said, look, let's just call it even. Okay. Whether I owe you or you owe me, the friendship is just too important to sacrifice over this. And we've been friends ever since, even to the extent where when he came out of the closet and shared with me, I looked at it and I'm going, well, what do you want me to do with that information? Mm-hmm. You think that because you're telling me this, I'm going to change my view of you? You're my best friend. We've been through grade school, high school, and college together. This doesn't matter. I mean, it matters because I want you to be happy too, but it doesn't matter as far as our relationship is concerned. And I think that that's one of the things too, that our lives are made up of all of these different types of relationships at all the different levels. And it seems to me that sometimes we lose sight of the fact that that's what's really important, not the issues, but the relationship. And well, sometimes we unconsciously sacrifice the relationship on the altar of rightness,
Yeah, and I think just listening to the way you described that interaction, there was a lot of tools that you were using at that time to navigate that experience to assure that you guys worked it out. You were using active listening skills, so he was listening, he was hearing you out, you were hearing him out. You were curious. You were curious into what he was trying to say and share with you. And you were open-minded and flexible to take that information and be willing to learn about it and willing to see it through his perspective so that it didn't close off the relationship just because of some specific details about him.
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue talking more about this as we go on in our program here. I'm Richard Dugan, and it's Dr. Johnny Lopes, correct?
That's right.
And it's Reinvent Yourself. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Why don't you stay right where you are?
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan here with Dr. Johnny Lopes. We're talking about Reinvent Yourself in the present tense. Do it now. You don't want to wait in that regard. Essential tools from a Brooklyn psychiatrist who has seen it all. That's an interesting phrase to put in there because I have a feeling that as life goes on, sometimes I thought I'd seen it all until now. And I have to say that and working in the business that I have for the last almost coming close to 40 years, It's astounding to me some of the things that surprise me every so often, and actually that's kind of a good thing because at least it, in more ways than one, keeps me interested and alert to expect. A matter of fact, one of the programmers who I detested the most back in the 80s that at a station that I worked for had a slogan, a great line that I've held on to ever since, and it's expect the unexpected. And that's life. You just never know what's going to happen. You don't know who's going to come across your path.
Yeah.
And yes, I'm sure you would agree, Johnny, that there are people who do indeed pass through our lives. They come in for a period of time. They're there and they serve, so to speak, serve a purpose. So, I mean, we serve them, they serve us in whatever capacity. And then we drift apart. You know, our paths will converge and then separate for short periods and sometimes for long periods. I think that as important as these relationships are, as we talked near the end of the last segment, I think that's another aspect, too, that we need to acknowledge that. I mean, I have friends that I've worked with, I became very close with in a short period of time at different radio stations, and actually shed tears over and with on their departure. Haven't heard from them since. And on the one hand, that's okay. I don't feel as though there's any unfinished business, mind you, but our time, we did our time served, so to speak, and we had a great time. I have fabulous memories.
Yeah.
Learning as well, a great education in the process. I have to say that we had a blast, but you can't go back and relive it. You can't recreate it in the present. And that doesn't mean that they're going to be in your life until the day you die or they die.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that I think a lot of us, and myself included, from time to time, it's like, man, I wish we could have continued down that path. I mean, we were having such a blast and so on and so forth. Hey, you know, things change and life goes on.
And the valuable thing from that story is, do you negate the time that you had in the great friendship and the experiences you had? Or when the door closes, do you sort of find yourself reneging and identifying that you don't have any friendships, nothing good ever happens to you? Because I have a lot of folks who come to see me, and this is sort of chapter one of my book a little bit, where a lot of folks struggle with these automatic negative thoughts, and they sort of are quick to deny some really nice past experiences. So I'll have somebody who's maybe trying to succeed and let's say as an artist or an actor in the city, and part of their history would be they did this show or they had this gallery where they met some really interesting people and their work was shown off and they got really nice accolades, and it's been 6 months to a year later and maybe they haven't had the experiences they have. And it's fascinating how they're quick to come to my office and say, nothing works out for me, I don't meet anybody, nobody's interested in my work. And I'm sitting there listening to them and I'm fascinated that just 10 minutes ago you were sharing with me about how 6 months to a year ago, you had this really wonderful experience. So a lot of people, and I think this is, again, I hate to keep being perseverative about that word skill. It's that ability, that skill, to allow your memory to infiltrate your emotions today and not deny some of the wonderful experiences you've had in the past. You know, there's, like you said, there's going to be a lot of people that will come and go in our lives, a lot of great memories that will come and go. And if we can accumulate them into our memory and, you know, take a deep breath and smell the air and really hone in on the past and say, hey, there was some really nice stuff. Even though something's not happening today, you might be able to stabilize your feelings and allow yourself to work through maybe some of the loneliness or frustration you're having at the moment. But a lot of people really struggle with this, and it's almost like they compartmentalize their life in a way that was the past, this is now, and the past doesn't affect how I feel today. And those folks are always struggling with anxiety and sadness because they're not allowing these wonderful experiences they've had to make them feel good about how they've grown and really accumulated some nice experiences.
And on a more esoteric level, too.
It's about what?
On a more esoteric level, if you will, on a more spiritual level, if you will, when we shut those things off, maybe there's a message that's where either we're trying to tell ourselves or the universe is trying to tell us, i.e. our intuition, through those memories, or maybe that individual at that moment in time might be going through something, and if it's possible for us to make contact with them, just to say, hey, I was just thinking about you and just hope you're doing well. I mean, I've had that happen with my best friend, and he's been through some rough times to where, you know, sadly, I mean, at one point, he was living in his car. And as far as I know now, I haven't talked with him in maybe 5 or 6 months. But my understanding was he was doing better. He was working. He was finally getting back on his feet, you know, and it was a slow process. But at least he had an infrastructure. He had a network of people there that I kind of reminded him about when we talked about 2 years ago. I said, you're still home. You're still in Phoenix. I'm not. And you have friends there. I know you do. That you've made over the years that you could go to, as much as I would like to help you other than as a sympathetic ear and conversing, and I'll be more than happy to do that, but there are people that can provide a greater, more practical thing. So anyway, it was like I had that insight to kind of call him at that time, and I found out about all of this stuff and so on and so forth. So sometimes I think that when those things come into our minds, as you've just said, we don't want to shut them off. They're coming through for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all people are capable of the memory and the emotional attachment that we had to close people in our lives. A lot of times what's really sad for me in my practice is that there is a little bit of a social anxiety that comes through when we want to make that call or send that email or write that text, where we're a little anxious about what the feedback will be from reaching out. Oh, maybe the person's not going to say hi back, or maybe the person's not going to be as enthusiastic of hearing from me. And I tell those folks, that shouldn't be the issue. The issue is, and I'll try to connect it to how you're saying it, is that there's something driving you to reach out to them. How they respond is not going to be your issue. That's up to them and where they are in time and place. But if you feel that energy, that something inside you is telling you that you need to reach out to them, try to only focus on that. Focus on what it is that is motivating, inspiring you to do that, and go for it. And don't worry about what the response is, but know that it's a beautiful thing, and it takes a lot of strength for you to be the one who's proactive to do it.
Yeah, and I think that, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of, you know, sort of the character-building aspects of our youth, and the various events that went on that we may or may not have had any control over. Our parents may or may not have been able to have any kind of influence. The one thing that I remember hearing a lot from parents of kids who were being bullied was the frustration that they would have liked to have done a better job at keeping them safe, but they just couldn't do it.
Right.
You know, for because they're both working, and I mean, for whatever the reasons are. And in a lot of instances, and it seems to me that during the 80s and 90s, we went through some interesting psychological phases. And I remember these because I was going through some, I went through in the early 80s, a self-improvement program called LifeSpring. And then in the 90s, it was Omega and or Delta Vector. And what I noticed was how in the 80s it was blame the parents. It's the parents' fault. It's
right.
It's all of the people around you, and they're the ones to blame for who and what you, why you are the way you are, and what's holding you back. Then in the 90s we began to start taking a little more responsibility and realizing, oh, it wasn't them, because this is now, and this is the only place where I can deal with the issues that I need to deal with. And I honestly think that we've gone to a higher level here in the 21st century where we're still saying that. But on a greater level, I remember somebody saying that as important as you've talked about the stories, you know, that we have of our past, I heard someone say that it's time to let go. You don't need to go rehash them and heal from them and create new memories for them so that they don't bog you down anymore. You just don't deal with them. You don't need to deal with them anymore. You are in the here and the now. You are who you are for whatever reason and however that came about. And now it's time for you to just move forward. Your thoughts on that type of philosophy?
You just initiated my book. That is my book. Now that I should have recorded you saying that and somehow connected it to when you opened the first page of my book, because my book is, I was inspired to write my book because I felt that as psychiatry and psychology is moving a little bit away from the Freudian model to which we just lie people on the couch and reflect on their childhood traumas, we're moving towards more of a practical approach. You are who you are. You're an accumulation of your parents, your experience as a child, the traumas, and what forth. And I want you to be as successful as you could possibly be. And it's 2015. I hope you're probably operating at a pretty good level. But now let's just be humble and recognize that maybe along the way there might have been some skills that were a little not as nurtured because of the accumulation of these experiences. And now, if you want to work on them, read my story, be inspired that look at the traumas I had, and I became, somewhat successful. And if I can do it, you can do it too. Because I'm not going to sit back and just spend all my life being angry at what my parents could provide for me because their parents didn't provide it for them. It's a circle of life. We can rehash this for hours. But over time, I realized it wasn't their fault because they didn't have the skill set because their parents didn't give it to them. Let me take responsibility and let me identify for myself what are my weaknesses. And just like going to work out, I mean, I start my book with chapter one about becoming a marathon runner, which I have no runners in my family, but my wife inspired me to be a marathon runner. It's hard. It's challenging. It takes time, but I wanted to do it. And it took me 2 years to do it. And the same way with life. If you struggle with relationships, you struggle with handling your emotions, you struggle with this, it's just like training for a marathon. If you take your time, contemplate about it, think about it, and work on it, you can become better at it. And that's what I'm hoping to achieve.
Well, I'm hoping that more and more people will do just that. It's interesting, too, that it also, these stories that we have lived with and that have sort of, that have made us who we are, also impact a lot of the decisions that we make today, a lot of the positions, opinions for that matter, that we might take on. And I find it interesting, too. This seems to come up in my mind quite often in these programs. In an interview that I did 25 years ago with a Christian musician. And he was born and raised in what was called the Jesus Movement here in California. And he moved out to New England when he was an adult with his wife and his family. And he was sitting in his writer's room looking out at in New England at the leaves turning and falling from the trees. And he began to contemplate, and this again, coming from his perspective, what he believed, not questioning whether what he believed was correct, but was what he believed what they told him to believe or what he believed, what he had chosen in terms of himself. And the more I think about that, the more I think it's hard to separate those two because we are so influenced by all of the people that come into our lives from the time we come into this world. And it's like, I'd like to say that the book Reinvent Yourself is a unique, and it was born through Dr. Johnny Lopes from a vacuum, okay? No influence whatsoever, but that isn't true. That everything, and that's, then it even has taken me into the realms of intellectual property rights. There's a passage in the Bible that says that there is nothing new under the sun. And if there is this influence that passes from one generation to the next, then how can anybody claim the rights to something that they were influenced by? Because we're all influenced. I mean, if you or I were musicians and you started writing music, There's going to be somebody that's going to be able to come along and say, I'm sorry, Johnny, but I'm going to sue you for using that little riff in your piece of music.
Right.
Well, but you influenced me. So how do you separate that? You can't.
Right. Yeah. And that was part of my inspiration to write my book, is that inherently, you know, the tools I provide in certain ways, of course, have been written about in other variety of ways. But when I was doing homework about wanting to write a self-help book, I never came across a self-help book where the psychiatrist or the mental health practitioner themselves were being vulnerable to expose their story and share how they came from a low middle class, pretty violent upbringing, and still were able to manage to move past that and get ahead. So inherently what makes my book unique is that intertwined with the self-help manual aspects are my stories that I use for, you know, personal inspiration to others to say, hey, there's this doctor, and he's willing to expose himself. So maybe if he can do it, I can do it too. And I think that's something that I could provide that a lot of folks, other self-help books, couldn't.
Now, that's an interesting perspective, too. Do you think that that characteristic, shall we say, of being willing to share our shadow side, if you will, to the rest of the world, not only certainly makes us vulnerable, not only removes any kind of specter of our being anything other than human, but also does draw people in to want to listen more so because, in your case, for example, you've been willing to do that.
Absolutely. I think especially in 2015, where most folks are being influenced by media figures and the internet and what needs to be said, it's almost becoming too much, where people are being overexposed by influence and they're having to sort of choose which way to go. It might be almost to the point where I'm concerned with our teenagers, where I find they're not developing a voice for themselves or learning to look at life through their own lens, because they're overexposed by the media and they're being too greatly influenced at a point where their minds are too fragile to handle the intensity of the real world experiences. But, you know, trying to be a good guy, you try to choose your battles and say, at least for me, if there's people out there that are willing to sort of go into the side of working on themselves as opposed to staying with the media or maybe being a victim incessantly, that they'll be willing to take on my story and say, I want to be more on this side mm-hmm. of life, as opposed to a passive side where I continue to blame my parents, my upbringing, on why I'm not moving forward.
I've also noticed, too, that, and you may have also, that people who are in the spotlight, who are in the public light on a regular basis, be they celebrities of stage, screen, or political, those who are called out, shall we say, and who say, yes, I'm sorry, I did that, it seems to go away a lot faster than those who say, oh, no, I didn't do that. And even religious figures, I remember back in the 80s that happened. And the one phrase kept rolling through my head with those who were protesting was the phrase from Shakespeare, me dost think thou protestest too much.
Mm.
And be careful what you rail against, because odds are, if you stay focused on that one thing, I'm going to guess you're probably involved in it too, in some way, shape, or form. And nine mm-hmm. times out of 10, that's what happened back in the 80s. And it's unfortunate, too. But again, that's the way that they were raised. That's how they were taught, whether it be political, as I say, whether it's political, religious, actors and actresses and so forth. And I think that you're right. I think that in one sense, there can be too much. I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you a little bit about this, the whole aspect of reinventing yourself, which I touched upon at the front of the program in terms of technology, the 21st century, how much of our modern world and technology do you think plays a role in our inability to achieve the things that we want, to move beyond those things that are holding us back to greater heights, if you will?
Greatly. I think for the most concerning aspect of being in the 21st century with technology is that it's an easy escape for a lot of people. So there's a lot of people who maybe have anxiety about social situations, anxiety about working with others as a team, as a community, and a lot of folks are easily being swayed by the computer to avoid having to interact with the world and having to develop those tools and skills to manage our day-to-day. So there's that aspect that's quite concerning. But from the another angle, which I'm worried about technology, is that just in terms of relationships, active listening skills, willing to focus and be present for others so that we can nurture. While we're speaking, I'm thinking about the idea of how many mothers are at the playground with their children, or, you know, actually, I shouldn't say that. I apologize. Even in New York, a lot of mothers or fathers mm-hmm. are with their children in the playgrounds, and the kids are trying to engage with the parent, and they're on their cell phone, and
yeah.
they're texting, or they're checking their email. So I'm concerned that we're moving away from learning how to engage and work with each other, and I'm finding that people are becoming less tolerant of having conversation with others and communicating with others. And you know, you brought up the idea about learning from the Greeks. I mean, how did the Greeks teach us their story? It was through stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not doing as much storytelling anymore if we're so focused and reading about, you know, not that I don't enjoy this, but we know from time to time, but reading about the most famous cat or something like that
mm-hmm.
on BuzzFeed or another website.
Sure.
You know, those are all good things for entertainment, but we're moving away from being able to nurture and help each other through stories and interactions. That's concerning to me.
Well, I know that when I first got involved with computers back in 1994, which seems like ancient history, I remember the gentleman who introduced me to the computer had to get me over the biggest fear of all, and that was that I knew somewhere on the keyboard there was a red button. It was hidden somewhere. That I was going to hit it, and I was going to erase the entire computer. And once I got over that, I flew through it. But then a concern began to enter into my mind, the very concern that you've elucidated, that it that I was going to spend so much time on the computer that I wasn't going to have connection with the rest of the world. And I was married. I didn't have any kids. We had some animals, and my parents still lived in the area, and so on and so forth. And what ended up happening was the computer actually brought me closer to my dad, who is still alive, by the way. He's actually 84 this year and going strong. But it actually helped us to connect more so than we did when I was growing up. Not that we were ever estranged, mind you, but that it wasn't nearly as close as I kind of envied my younger brother who really connected with my dad, because my younger brother ended up going to DeVry. He's an electrical design engineer for Disney. So it gives you an idea of where his mind was. Well, my dad's mind was kind of along those same lines. He was a computer programmer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really didn't have that kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
But I still loved the man. We still got along. Everything was fine. But I just, it was like, wow, this is very cool. I'm learning a lot about the computer, and gee, I'm actually able to talk about this kind of stuff with my dad. And so we began a relationship, and I had one of those, you might call them Norman Rockwell events in my life, although I don't know that Rockwell ever painted or drew a picture like this. You know how, and I know this happened a lot, I'm sure, even to you in New York, there in Brooklyn, your dad taking you to a ball game?
Oh, now at my age, I take my dad to the ball games, but...
Well, my dad never took me to a ball game because we never had a ball team until the Diamondbacks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there I was at the age of 38, 39, 40. I'm taking my dad to both his and my first major league ball game. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But I think that if we are able to, if we haven't become so dependent upon our technology, and I've tried not to. A matter of fact, when I switched over to a smartphone, it allowed me to stay in the living room with my wife. Not that I was on it all the time. I would check my email, or if it rang, I could answer the phone, but it was sitting on the nightstand next to the couch. And that's where it was. And we were sitting there, and at least I was there in the room with her, and we were enjoying a program. And if there was something important that I needed to deal with, I didn't have to walk. I didn't have to go into the other room, separating myself from her. So, you know, there are little things that we're able to do to keep the relationship.
And again, I'm always in favor for how technology is advancing, but I don't know if you, I have a few friends who already bought the Apple Watch, and I got to be honest, I'm actually pretty proud of Apple that one of their influences to create the Apple Watch, even though they're just trying to advance technology in their products, is that they measured that when we're engaging, if you and I were at a coffee shop having a coffee, if every time our cell phone buzzed for a text or an email, it doesn't seem like a long time, but you're distracted by the buzz, then your hand has to go into your pocket, you have to pull the phone out, you have to look down, you have to turn the phone on and read that message. And that's like, you know, it's about 8 to 10 seconds, and if it happens multiple times, that's multiple times that we're being removed from the engageability. And the idea about the Apple Watch, one of the influences is that it would be so much faster and wouldn't take as much avoiding of eye contact if your watch was able to read the message to you from your phone, the text or the email, and you just quickly turn your wrist, you glance your eyes over it, you take a look at it, and you get right back to engaging with the person. So, you know, maybe there was this 5-10 year period where it was sort of the initial part of technology's initiation to this level that was causing a little bit of a dissociation, but maybe these folks will be a little bit more humanistic as they develop new technologies and new products that will allow us to have less disengagement, be able to see our messages, but get right back on to the person that's in front of us.
I agree with you on that. And even taking that another step, I don't know if you've seen the movie Wild.
No, I did not.
It's a movie, for those who aren't familiar, it's a movie, I guess it's starring Reese Witherspoon, and she walks, I can't even remember the name of the trail, but it goes from Mexico to Canada here in the West. The experiences that she, and it's a true story, and apparently that movie has spurred hundreds, if not thousands of people to take the, what is it, a couple thousand mile trek from Mexico all the way up. They have to go through the Mojave Desert. So I would be doing that in December if I did it at all. And there's no service out there. You can't be connected because there's nothing to connect to out in the middle of the wilderness. But people are experiencing phenomenal reactions, if you will, or experiences, if you will, to not being connected for the weeks or month or more that it takes them to traverse this trail. And even though they will go back to their homes and their technology, I'm sure that they're going to have a greater appreciation for being disconnected. And nature seems to be one of the greatest teachers that I have been privileged to observe, especially where we live here in Santa Barbara. Up on the mountain above the city, seeing the various wildlife that travel through, whether it be quail or bear. Kid you not, we had a bear go through our property once. As well as the animals that we have of our own, the domesticated, the dogs and cats and so forth. So it seems to me as though, I think you're right, that maybe on some level too, as you've described, I think that's great that, you know, maybe Apple has come up with something that helps. But I would still like for us to carry on a conversation. Let's say you should decide that you're going to visit Santa Barbara, and we were going to continue this conversation in studio. I think that I would probably turn my phone off and engage with you with the eye contact. And yeah, radio is real good for hand gestures and the hand gestures in a conversation on this level or a deeper or higher level, if you will. But I think that, again, everybody has to make that choice. But what's really cool, I think, Johnny, is the fact that at least it's not something that's been implanted in us. At least it's separate from us and we can disconnect. I hope it always stays that way for a long time to come. I know people think, oh, it would be so cool if I had that, you know, in my ear all the time, surgically implanted.
Right.
I think that there would come a point where you'd wish you didn't. Because it is really nice, I have to say, that when my wife and I take a drive, we don't use GPS to get from point A to point B. We use it as a source of entertainment, especially when we deviate from the path we've put in, and then it tells us, okay, now you need to make these changes in your direction in order to get back on your path. And we say, we don't care. We actually talk to it, and we say, we don't care. Or we'll tell it to shut up, you know, but it's a source of entertainment, not frustration.
Right.
So we have fun with it that way. And we also have fun with this radio program. I want to thank you so much. Before we wrap up the program, I want to thank you for
such a pleasure. Thank
taking
you for
the time.
Me.
Reinvent Yourself is the title of the book, Essential Tools from a Brooklyn Psychiatrist Who Has Seen It All. Why psychiatry?
Well, the joke, I definitely want to go to med school, and I don't like blood, so that knocked out a lot of avenues. But no, more because I think the spirituality, a part of my childhood, the ability to connect to people, to listen to people, I thought psychiatry was the closest to that for me in terms of a role for my adult life.
Interesting. Now, before I let my guests go, I usually have three basic questions to wrap up the program. So the first to you is, who is Johnny Lopes?
I was not prepared for that. Well, let me go along with my inspiration for the book. Johnny Lopes is just a blue-collar kid from Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn, who put himself out there, took a lot of risks, made a lot of mistakes, was willing to work with a lot of people, said a yes a lot, and was very fortunate to become a professional actor for 18 years, child psychiatrist, author, husband, son, and if I can do it, so can you.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Have others be mindful that the way they are doesn't necessarily mean it's always the way they have to be. That with time and effort and love and hard work, change is possible and good things can come to those who are willing to make those changes.
And who inspires you?
A lot of people through my life have inspired me. I think right now it's actually my patients. I think seeing them in my office trying hard, trying to make a change, trying to acknowledge their struggles, come to terms with the pain they have inside, just really inspires me to say that whenever I'm feeling down or tired, that there's people trying to cope with much more and that I shouldn't give up and continue to take on the journey that I promised myself that I would too.
And you've kind of spurred another question, not of the three that I normally ask, but as a psychiatrist, and you've been practicing for how long?
This is my fifth year.
And in that short 5 years, have you noticed any kind of change in the type of people who are coming for your assistance, if you will, your facilitation, in terms of issues dealt with, or even in terms of
as time has gone on, the issues.
Yeah.
Or
something that maybe has surprised you that, you know, because you say you've seen it all. So.
Yeah, no, I hate to say it. Unfortunately, no.
So pretty much all the issues can be codified down into just a few. In other words, you can always take it back to a core.
Yeah. Either going to be relationships or self-esteem or social issues or dealing with their parents, dealing with their childhood, various trauma. I think psychosocial, there's only so much that, again, I've just seen so much in working with the most underserved people in Brooklyn, New York, to the most famous actors, musicians, and CEOs. I've seen the full gamut over the last 5 years, and kind of unfortunately not surprised by much anymore.
Well, I'm very excited about the fact that you're out there and you're assisting people and helping them and
thank you.
You know, giving them the various choices available that they may never have even thought of before, but by going to you, they're now aware of them, and it's like they can choose them or not, but at least now they know. And I used to say on this program that once you've listened to this program, you can't unhear it. So now you're going to have to deal with the information. And I mean that in a kind way, that I hope that you will. I hope that you'll take it in, consider the possibilities, and consider picking up a copy of the book, Reinvent Yourself. Essential Tools from a Brooklyn Psychiatrist Who Has Seen It All, Dr. Johnny Lopes. And again, the website is the same, drjohnnylopes.com. We encourage you to check out the website, check out the book, and check out Dr. Johnny. And we thank you again for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, sir.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time. Love to Lal.